Good morning, members and everyone. I'd like to call the Environment, Natural Resources, Policy, and Finance Committee to order here on Thursday, February 23rd. We have the minutes before us. Appreciate the Representative Hoppe is here. He'll move the minutes from February 22nd, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair, it would be my honor to move the minutes.
Thank you. We've got the minutes before us. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all those in favor of the minutes as presented, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes are approved. Members, first on the list today, Representative Howe has got House File 457, with the intention of his chair to lay it over. So, Representative Howe, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for hearing this bill. What this does is it extends the amount of the time that the Lake Association has to use the $200,000 that was provided to them to help fight the AIS, the aquatic invasive species known as the starry stonewort. What happened last year is by the time they had available to the funds and been able to set up their program, they had to do a test. Well, part of that test was they had to see if the plant would regrow. Well, by the time they got the harvester in there to harvest this stuff and the divers in to pull the weeds and put the herbicide down, the growing season had stopped. So now they have to wait and extend the time to see if that starry stonewort is going to regrow. And by the time they do that, the timeline for using the funds will be gone. So this just extends the time to give them the availability to see if this process actually works. And then go back in there and do a much larger removal of the product. So that's the bill. Give them more time to actually see if this works.
Thank you, Representative Howe. Anybody have any questions or comments? Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Howe, so is this what I'm going to need to do if I have the same issue on Lake Vermilion or Burnside Lake with the aquatic invasive species, is bring a special bill like this to the committee?
Representative Hall.
I don't know that, Representative Eklund. This was the first lake in the state to be identified with the starry stonewort. There has been no real process anywhere in the states that have this on making any progress to remove it. This was an $800,000 program to try to remove this to see if this process would work. We granted them $200,000 of that $800,000 to help them in this process. There wouldn't be an extension of time if we would have got this going during the growing season. This just extends the time that we're going to allow them to use the money.
And to that point, to Representative Howe and Representative Eklund, I would say that this is kind of a test project. As Representative Howe said, this is the first case of starry stonewort. I want to say it correctly that time, first time ever, I think. It's something that we did as, it's basically ongoing research is what it's about.
Absolutely.
Representative Eklund.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just see this, for instance, some of my lakes have the rusty crayfish and other things that they don't know how to deal with, and so I just see this as possibly a little troubling. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Howell, I'm glad you're addressing the issue. You know, this is an important issue statewide, but I'm just wondering about, the return on the money. If we're going to invest in that one lake, you know, is there a return commercially? How many resorts are on that lake? Should we be looking at lakes up in around New York Mills or Vermilion, I guess, where there's a lot of commercial return for taking care of those lakes? Question.
Representative Hall.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Sundin. This is just an extension of the funds, but to that point, if this works here, this technology or this process can be extended to all the lakes in the entire state that have to deal with starry stonewort. Even though this was the first lake to be identified with it, Now there's been additional lakes. If this process works, and if we don't extend the time to use this money, we won't know if this process works, because it'll quit before we get the opportunity.
Representative, follow up.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just kind of a general statement, you know, why are we doing it right on one isolated lake rather than investing money where there's, you know, a viable return right now? So you don't need to respond. Thank you.
Representative Hubel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Powell, thank you for bringing this bill. I don't know if everybody's seen the pictures of what's happened to the lake, but I would urge everybody to try and see them. I don't know if you have them or whatever. This stone wart is, in my opinion, much worse than milfoil ever will be. This experimental project could be rolled out and done with other lakes, because if it does start spreading, and it probably will, we're going to have to deal with it, or Lakeshore, as you know it, is going to be gone, just as on this lake. Is that correct?
President Hall.
Absolutely. I tell you what, there's parts of this lake I think you could probably walk on with this starry stone wart. It is that thick. You can't take a boat motor through there without clogging up. It stops. And this is right by the lake access, and that's where they're trying to make this do this experiment. They've got a brand new piece of equipment that I'd never seen that actually comes in there, drops down, and harvests it, kind of like a combine, if you would. But it's an odd deal. Never seen it like anything like it before, but it was quite a process. And then they had divers down there pulling the weeds after that. Then they put the herbicide down. And we just ran out of time in the growing season. Otherwise, we would have had a good idea if this is going to work or not. So that's the request, is just to extend the time to use the funds.
Representative, you don't follow up?
No, sir.
Thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very briefly, first, I think this is a great idea to go ahead with this. But second, I think it's important to note that starry stonewort comes from a European country, the name of which slips my mind right now. But the interesting thing is that in that original home, it's an endangered species. So I'm just pleading the case for research, that we do the research we need to understand these things so we can eliminate them.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. And I think that this is a real valid issue that we're dealing with here, and I think the money is being well spent, and the issue's been raised. I think that we have to recognize that this is a test project to try to prevent the spread of this. And we've spent tens and tens of millions of dollars of fighting aquatic invasive species around the state of Minnesota, and this is just one very, very small part of that entire project. So, Representative Howell, I commend you on the bill. I think it's a great idea, and I look forward to continuing to work with you on this issue. So, final word.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the Claims Committee. This is, you know, this isn't a new money that we're going to spend. This is just extension of the time to allow the project to completion, to see if it's actually a viable process. So, thank you. Thank you, Committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Howell. I think this is a good thing, that prevention is better than cleanup, than getting to it quickly. I think what some of our members were asking about was the economic impacts, and I don't know, Mr. Chair, maybe this is a question for you. So the tourism budget, was there a tourism overview in the subcommittee? I'm not on, so we haven't heard about tourism and the governor's tourism initiatives. Is that going to be scheduled next week, or when are we going to hear about tourism?
Representative Hanson, that question, we will hear it in the full committee here, and not exactly sure when that'll be, but we'll do it at the appropriate time, as is determined by the chair.
And
if you have a suggestion for that, I'd be happy to talk to you offline.
And Mr. Chair, so that'll be the agency coming in and going through their initiative?
Yeah, we'll allow some time for that, but it won't take very long. Representative Howell.
Mr. Chair, just as far as the economic impact, this the Sauk River goes through this this Lake Coronas. That soft river feeds the entire chain of lakes through Richmond. There is dozens and dozens of resorts along the chain of lakes and through this. As that, if that continues to flow down the chain of lakes and through the Sauk River, that eventually ends up in the Mississippi River. You draw the conclusion on the ecological and the economic impact of where this can go.
Thank you. And with that, the bill is laid over. Next up. Oh. Well, look at that. We'll just do the next bill, House File 1106. My intention is to lay that over. So first I'm going to move House File 1106 for possible inclusion. And then I'd also like to move the A1 amendment. And I'll ask Mr. Meyer to come forward on that, please. The A1 amendment, you have it before you. It gets the bill in the shape that I would like it. And to the A1 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. The amendment to a House File 1106 is language that the department and the author and the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association have worked out. These funds were dedicated to wolf management back when the wolf was first delisted. Unfortunately, since it's been relisted federally, this is our only source of revenue to continue our wolf monitoring and population, so when the wolf is delisted, we'll be able to have a season as soon as possible to reinstate our season. So we're using these funds right now for our annual wolf surveys and population work that we need to maintain. And we're supportive of removing this dedication one year after the wolf is relisted, or delisted, I should say. At that point, we'll have our licensing and our lottery dollars to fund those activities.
So, members, you've heard the amendment. I'd like to move the amendment this time. All those in favor of the amendment as presented, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The amendment is approved. So, with regards to the bill, you've heard Commissioner Meyer talk. This is about roughly $300,000 a year that's going into that. And once the feds take action, we'll have that back here, and we can use that money for other things. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Meyer. So I agree with that the deer hunters should not be paying for wolf management if the season comes back. But based on past performance, does the DNR believe they have enough revenue from wolf licenses and the lottery to cover the cost? I mean, or will you be dipping into the Game and Fish Fund to cover these tasks?
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, at this point in time, our estimates are that it should be self-sustaining based on lottery applications and license fees.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you don't need any other statutory authority for amounts or process relating to the license?
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, not related to this, but related to some other provisions.
Representative Hansen.
I think we did have that overview. So, and that's my concern, is if just taking the issue of the hunting out, but looking at the revenue, if it doesn't provide enough, then that causes more pressure on the Game and Fish Fund. If we have a shortfall because of hunting.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Meyer,
Representative Hansen, as everyone knows, the Game and Fish Fund is going into the red here in the out years, and we're going to have to deal with that issue as we come forward. Managing the wolf population is a priority for us, so we'll have to deal with that compared to other needs and wants within that fund as well. But as we've talked about with our budget proposals, the Game and Fish Fund is in jeopardy, so we need to figure that out. And our whole licensing, our whole fee-based system within the budget is, you know, unfortunately it's been neglected for so long, all the accounts are going in the red, and we look forward to working with the legislature on those issues in the coming weeks.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe Commissioner Meyer. Just, we have a lot of new folks on the committee. What is the license fee for the Wolf Hunt and the lottery?
Mr. Chair, I believe the lottery is $5 probably for the application, and I think the license is $32.50 right now for Wolf. So the resident application, the resident license fee is $30, the non-resident is $250, and the Wolf application fee is $4.
Representative Hansen?
Okay.
Any further questions or comments? With that, House File 1106 is laid over. Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. Next up, we have Representative Neuberger.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Representative Neuberger. House File 1387, it's the intention of the Chair to lay this over for possible inclusion. So to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 1387 that we have here before us is a response to some of the changes that we have seen in the regulatory environment when it comes to our farmers. I represent an area that is very dependent on agriculture. Up until about 2013, we didn't see, there were some headaches involved with our local farmers who have been there for generations, but nothing that they couldn't deal with. After 2013, there was some marked change in how the DNR was interacting with our family farms. Again, some of these have been there for many generations, it is our understanding that they're trying to put together a template to apply across the state. There are some areas that they're focusing on right now to try to get the groundwork for that template. One of them is Bonanza Valley, the other one is Straight River, and then the other one, the third one, is in my district. It is the Little Rock watershed area. Suffice to say, members, what we've had is the DNR has come in. They've had community meetings. Once a month, they usually go for several hours where they bring in the local farmers and the irrigators, and they're trying to hammer out a groundwater management plan. It's been a frustrating and long experience, which we don't see a whole lot of results in. We're having a lot of problems with our family farms. Folks are calling us, and the changes that we've seen in the last 3 to 4 years have been excessive delays in trying to get their permits. Excessive paperwork trying to get their permits. Also, fees that can run into the tens of thousands of dollars that are hitting these people trying to get these things accomplished. We think, members, that having some guardrails into statute will help to even the balance here so that our farmers can just do what they've always done for hundreds of years is farm and provide the food that we need. I will walk through the bill really quickly. The first section of the bill has to do with calcareous fens. A fen, very briefly, is just it's a type of plant that thrives in cooler in a cooler environment, in a shady environment, very wet environment. They are throughout Minnesota. They require a fair amount of water to be available to them. Fens have been around for hundreds of years, and they have endured multiple drought and dry seasons. They are a hardy species, or they're a hardy type of plant there that's going on in those fens. The next section has to do with permits, and this is a really big, one of the biggest drivers that we have for this language, members. Right now, if you have a family farm, grandpa had it, grandma, grandpa had it, they passed it to mom and dad, and now it's in your hands, and you want to pass it to your, keep it in the family. If you have a well permit that you've been using to irrigate your land for generations, if you sell your property, that permit will become null and void, and whoever takes over the farm has to go through the whole process all over again, and again, that's arduous at best. So what my bill would do here, members, is it would allow for a better transfer of an existing permit on existing property. Members, one of the things that has not been taken into consideration, if you go to Subdivision 8, Line 2.3, one of the things that has really not been taken into consideration, at least in our opinion, is the economic impact that these groundwater management plans will have on the communities, that they are drafted for. I think that that is a major question that has not been addressed, and it needs to be when we move forward with these groundwater management plans. Also, members, if we keep walking through here on the next page, we will see if you have a denial if you are in putting for a permit and it's denied, that they have, the DNR needs to provide you with all of the data as to why they denied your permit. Some folks are getting a deluge of data. Some of them aren't getting much at all. So that's been at least the experience that I've been informed about. And what we would just like to do is to make sure there's some consistency in this process. Also, members, if you flip to the last page, 4.12, me being the keen-eyed legislator that I am, noticed this was a revised typo. This is redundant language. It's already in the bill. I'm going to show the revisor's office a great amount of grace because they work with us on moment's notice and we all put them through a lot of stress. So, but I will, it is my intention if we need to, is I will strip that redundant language out as it moves forward. And then finally, members, the last section of the bill, it talks about a well interference or a well sealing. If you have an old well, if you have a well interference claim against, that they simply have to factor in some depreciation. I've got some folks here that can testify, some local farmers. These are folks, that have been at all these meetings month after month after month. A lot of them are family farmers, and they're here to share a bit of their personal history with you. I'd like to call Alan Peterson forward.
Mr. Peterson, welcome to the committee. And as you sit down, will you please identify yourself and who you represent and proceed with your testimony. Thank you for being here.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Alan Peterson. I farm in the Clear Lake area. I irrigate. I'm also the state president of the Irrigators Association of Minnesota and have been for the past 15 years. Some of the parts of the bill that Representative Neuberger talked about, I've had to deal with in the past 4 to 5 years that we felt was finally time to address. The last part that he talked about, the well interference area, I've dealt with many well interferences in the past few years that involve old wells, very old wells, and we're just attempting to give the DNR a direction on how to put a value on those wells, and we find that it's the DNR is supposed to be that neutral third party involved in a well interference, but they walk into the case and they'll just state that, don't worry, the irrigator has to provide you with a brand new well because you deserve water, and so we're just trying to give some direction there. I've dealt with many aquifer tests for irrigators in the past few years, and basically I'd like just to see some direction for the DNR that if they require an aquifer test of an irrigator and the irrigator does it on his own, and these tests are not very cheap. They run from $10,000 to $40,000 depending on the complexity of the aquifer test that's being asked for, that they go by the science of the aquifer test. I've been involved in a number of them that basically showed no interference with whatever, a wetland, a fen, whatever, and the DNR will rule them inconclusive and still deny the permit. There's a part of the bill that deals with the preliminary well process, which has since been added in, I believe it was 2013, where you have to apply for a preliminary assessment of your project. And just in the last year, I've taken two phone calls where the person who applied for the preliminary straight out asked the DNR, once they had all the information from the preliminary process, what will I be required to do? And in the one case, they were told that, no, it looks like it should be good, everything should be fine, you can go ahead with your project. They got farther into the project, the DNR then required an aquifer test. The irrigator was quite mad about that. He said, had they told me that up front, I would not have done the project. And that's what I thought that the preliminary was supposed to do, was give everybody up front what they needed. I know there's another case where they're asking the DNR for the same information, and as the last that I knew about it, they were holding off on their project because the DNR had not told them whether they needed to or not, so they wouldn't involve that. One other place, to deal with the DNR, and I do meet, fairly regularly with them, because we depend on the DNR. The irrigators need the DNR. We need to stay in contact. But it gets frustrating when I get different answers from different DNR people, and one of those areas would be under temporary permits. In one area of the state, they're handing out temporary permits, and when we deal with a case in another area of the state, and I suggest, well, let's do a two-year temporary permit, and let's do some more studies, that DNR person will tell me, well, they're illegal, you can't do that. And I'm like, well, one place of the state is saying they can, and then the other place isn't. So I'd like just, at least that they could be on the same page and discuss that, and I guess that's about what I can bring forward.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. We do have a member question. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just was not understanding you when you were talking about the well interference part of this bill and the neighbor feeling like they deserved water. Help me out understanding what's going on here.
Mr. Peterson.
But you had said that DNR was telling people that they could get a new well because you deserve water. And
Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the state of Minnesota, there's a water priority system, and public drinking water is number one on that priority scale. Ag irrigation would be number three, and we have no problem with that scale. If I have a neighbor who would have a well interference complaint, and I was involved, I want my neighbor to have water also. Our problem with the interference system is a lot of these, for instance, in the St. James area last year, there were two well interference wells complaints in this, right in the same area. Both of those wells involved wells that were 60-plus years old. One had no data on it at all. It was so old. We just want a better way. Both of those wells, the DNR called 11 permittees. I claimed they were responsible for that. And both of those wells were replaced at full cost. The irrigators provided to pay for the new wells. We just feel that it's that's kind of unfair that, you have 50, 60-year-old wells. If the DNR, in most cases, would do more investigative work, they'd find out these wells were probably poor producing wells in the last number of years before this happened. And so I just would like to see a more streamlined process to figure out the value of that well when it comes back, like and the cost that it would be for me to help replace the water that homeowner needs.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. So the implication is that it would be the homeowner who has the responsibility to pay for the well if the well level is down. Is that what I'm understanding?
Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm only talking about the age of that well. I'm not talking about how much water was in it, could be in it, was it brand new, was at that time. We're just trying to help with a process to figure out what the responsibility of the high appropriator should be in the case. That's all I'm asking.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wagenius, excuse me, Representative Neuberger.
Thank you. I think what we're really trying to get at, and for clarification for the committee's sake, you
you have an existing irrigating well that's been there for generations. You have a home that's in the area that's been there for generations. Both wells have been there for 50 plus years. And then what you have is you start to have failure on the residential well, although nothing has changed. You start to see failure on the residential well. So an interference claim comes out, even though both wells have been going for 50 years. And it's quite possible that the residential well is into a different aquifer, or it's just crapping out. No, you're having problems with your equipment, okay? That's a technical term we use in the irrigator world. So point being is,
thank you.
If you start having well failure, well equipment failure, generally what we're finding happen is the trend that is starting to occur, at least to our knowledge, is that if you file a well interference claim and say, that irrigator over there is the reason why my house isn't getting water anymore, what we are seeing as a trend is that it tends to be a rubber stamp where the DNR will come in and say, yes, they will verify the interference, and now the irrigator has to pay for a new well for the resident. So if, you know, sorry, but the untold secret that it seems to be unfolding here is that if you've got a really old well on your house and you want a new one, if you file an interference claim, the farmer down the road is going to have to pay for it. And what we're looking for, now if that's true, they should. If that's true, they should. You're right, Representative Agenius. I know where you're going because you and I are tight, okay? But we are.
Oh,
okay. But if there is an interference, they should pay for it. But generally speaking, if there's not, that should not become the trend where it becomes carte blanche just to get a new well, because wells are expensive. And all we're asking for, members, and Mr. Chair, thank you, is just some consistency here. If there's an interference, then of course, then the irrigator should pay for it. But if there is not interference, then that has to go back on the homeowner, because sometimes those wells just wear out. The equipment does.
Officer Wagenius, you're in Lubbock are tight, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll take that. But here we're going carte blanche in the other direction and saying, for sure, the irrigator doesn't have to pay, just based on age. Even though it may be that well level is down because there's less water in the aquifer. So we've now flipped it and gone in the opposite direction. So it's carte blanche in the other direction. I think we'll have to have some more discussion about this.
Mr. Chair.
Representative,
thank you. Just quickly, Representative Wagenius, I'm sorry if you see it that way, but that's if the well interference claim shows that it's just an old well that's having issues, then that will be the data that will be used, and they should go back to the homeowner and say, guess what, you've got 75-year-old equipment, you probably should replace that. But if the well interference claim comes back and says, oh, no, it's the irrigator's fault, then they should pay for it. All we're asking for is consistency here.
The
language needs rewriting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I have one more testifier here.
Yeah, just we got Representative Hansen first, and then Hoppy.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And Representative Neuberger, in your testimony you said, it seems like what this is happening. And that's not evidence. I think it would be important to hear from the DNR, you know, the evidence here. Because it appears to me that you're proposing a one-size-fits-all solution when, you know, it depends on the day here, folks. Some days we can't have a one-size-fits-all because we have unique features. And then when you take into account unique features, then we need a one-size-fits-all. And the discussion about hundreds of years, these calcareous fens have been here for thousands of years, or tens of thousands of years, the features that are occurred. And so we're relatively recent visitors to this area or to the state, and we have impacts. They may be residences that are moving into the area and buying homes and sinking the well, or it may be long-term residents that have an old well, but it is different every part of the state, and this appears to me to be a one-size-fits-all solution that
puts the emphasis on the business rather than the residents, which is not what the priority ranking is supposed to be.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Representative Hansen, for your comments. Well, if you're telling me that I'm parking my car on the word seems, well, you're parking your car on the word that says appears. So, you know, we can argue semantics all day long and still argue. What I'm trying to get at here, and if you talk about the fence, Mr. Chair, thank you for your indulgence. These fence, as to your own testimony, I've been here maybe thousands of years. I believe that. And how many drought cycles and dry cycles have we had that these things have endured? These are not as fragile, because if they were, they would no longer be here. And if you're talking specifically about the fen language, Representative Hansen, this is just the language that we have would allow for a temporary reduction in resources, but it would need to be approved. And if you're looking at, if you're talking about a one-size-fits-all type of solution, yeah, we are. We're looking for a one-size-fits-all consistency, which we do not have. And as my testifier, Mr. Peterson, said here, we've got DNR officials that are giving contradictory answers depending on who you call and where you live. Some are saying it's great, go ahead and do it, and some are saying, no, it's illegal, you can't do it. So do we need consistency? Yes, because one size will fit all when it comes to some consistency. Does this mean we always favor the irrigators? No. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it'll favor the DNR. But again, what we're looking for is regulatory certainty, which we do not have.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Neuberger. You just said this is a one-size-fits-all. It's not an appearing that. I'm saying when we make the claims as to it's an old well, so it's that resident whose, quote, old well is the problem, I'd like the evidence on that.
Absolutely.
I'd like the evidence rather than the seems like. I'd like the DNR or the University of Minnesota to provide evidence as to what a calcareous fen is and why it's important. Because we can throw out as many cliches as we want, but at some point, maybe we should actually have testimony on the science on this. That would be what our job would be here, to try to protect the resource as well as the economy.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Neuberger, I'll also talk about Section 1 calcareous fens, just because it's fun to say.
thought that'd be funnier.
But it,
sorry, Stonewort.
Yeah, well, I guess I have a lot to compete with. But I think as you go forward with this bill, you probably should take another look at Section 1. We don't have very many calcareous fens in the state. They are pretty rare, and they're either fed by a seep or a spring or some sort of groundwater. And I think that might run you into trouble with the DNR or anybody else that has to approve it. And I would at least take another look at the language before you go to the next stop on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I represent Hoppe. That is sagely advice, which I will take into consideration, and we'll talk offline.
Thank you. Thank you. Next, Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And kind of pushing back on some responses I heard to Representative Virginius's comments about the depreciation of effect when you're taking a look at replacing wells. There's several issues that we haven't acknowledged is that, number one, you can have a situation where a new well goes into an area and a person who's already been there has got a well interference claim. Things were running fine until it went in. Their well might be 30 or 40 years old, and all of a sudden they're going to pay for the bulk of replacing their well when things were running fine until the new well went in. So now the homeowner who was there previously is going to have to shoulder most of the cost. That is not a fair situation. And the other thing that we have to take a look at is in many of these areas where we're starting to have problems, we've got water management areas because the aquifer is not recharging as fast as we're using it. This is a whole new area, and unfortunately, we can't have regulatory certainty here because we're entering in a whole new phase of how we've been approaching our water. Over the years, we've spent too much time of taking our water for granted. We have found out that we don't have enough water to go on endlessly the way we have. That is why we now have water management areas. And as a result, I feel that some of the things that are being brought up, there are some concerns here, but that's why we have water management areas and that they're trying to develop the resources to figure out how do you allocate the limited resources of water. And in some areas of the water management areas, you've got the groundwater is going down faster, and you've got people coming in asking to have more permits. So how do you reallocate those permits? Who do you start taking away from? Do you start taking away from other users? These are big questions that we haven't been able to answer yet, and we have to figure out. And I think that some of the things that you're bringing up in this bill here actually complicates it and is trying to reprioritize it. Is when I start seeing concerns about issues about the economic impact, it feels to me like we're trying to find a way around the current priority list that is established out there. And I think what we should be looking at is, first of all, allowing the science to come in, and then maybe coming back and taking a look at a wider amount of not only what the science is, but how do we approach it. And the reason I'm bringing up the approach on it is we've got regular times and what happens in times of severe drought. How does that impact in those points of times when the DNR starts coming back in? And I think what this does is this proposal that we have here does not really allow us to address those kind of concerns. And we need to be spending more time looking at some of the longer term, hearing some of the science, getting some of those folks in to address it. And I'll kind of leave it go at that moment. I'll probably have some more questions as I go forward, though. But I just kind of want to... first of all, raise up the one section here where it's got the that 2.5 depreciation. I think actually it would cause more harm than good, and that really should be eliminated out of the bill.
Thank you. Representative Neuberger, comment? Mr. Peterson?
Mr. Chair, thank you. At this time, again, I just want to, the short answer is, Representative Fisher, is this is not going to, we're not looking to tip the scales in one heavier on one side or the other. What we're looking for is some consistency. That's what we're looking for. And will there be well interference claims in the future? Yes. Will there be some claims where the irrigators are responsible for it? Yes. Will they have to pay for it? Yeah. But you know what? There's also on the other side of the equation, there are going to be a number of times where it is not their responsibility, where they are not at fault. And at this point in the game, the scales is tipped against them. So, like I said, what we're trying to do is just bring it back up so we have a fair playing field. That's all we're asking for.
Thank you. Representative Parkelson, and then Clark Jones.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing this bill forward. Representative Neuberger, I do think there are some genuine issues here that do need to be addressed. I'm personally familiar with some of these well interference situations, and what's really happened is the DNR has failed to properly evaluate the old wells before the process really got too far down the road. And then they just assume that that the well needs to be replaced and the irrigators need to pay for it. What we're asking for, I think what you're asking for, is that these wells be evaluated before someone has to pay for something that may not be worth anything in the first place. So, people deserve to have access to water, but they do not necessarily deserve to be bettered just because they happen to be close to somebody who's irrigating. So thank you for bringing this forward. This is important work. Irrigation is critical to the success of much of our agricultural industry, and I strongly support your bill.
Thank you. Representative Clark Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine is a comment, too. And when I see this bill, it makes me think of a company that's in my district. And I recognize that may be different than a family farmer situation. But I'd like to take advantage of the opportunity to share it. The company is Uniman. And Uniman does silica sand mining in a big way in Kasota Township and just across the river from St. Peter. And they use a lot of water. And they have a very important water permit. But with respect to both the wells and the fens, first of all, on the wells, their response, I just want to share, is that over the years they've determined that the path of least resistance for them is to just absorb that cost and redrill that well. And because they recognize they're using water at a large amount, and it is impacting local wells. I'm sure some of those are old homes. I'm sure some of them are maybe 100-year-old wells for all I know. And I don't know if the irrigators where you live, Representative Neuberger, could somehow arrange to coalesce or work together to do that, but it builds really strong neighbors. This is a silica sand mining company that has a lot of support locally, and that's a challenge for them, but they've worked hard at it. As for the fens, that was a deep challenge for them. There was a fens fairly near their main mining operation along the Minnesota River. I don't think the environmental folks at Uniman would call that a hardy structure. They would say it's very fragile. And they recognize that. And what they did is they, this is the hardest part for them to complete their permit. I believe it was the last part of their permit. And they worked a lot, and they kept working at it, working at it, rather than saying, well, we'll just let the fence go dry once in a while. Their approach was to seek some creative solutions. I don't understand how they did it. I know it was expensive, but they did it. And I guess as water issues become increasingly important in the state, and irrigation is critical to farming in certain parts of the state, so we've got to have the irrigation. I understand that. But we also have to be sensitive to the homeowners. And I just wanted to share that there's this interaction that, that maybe the irrigators could go visit the folks at Uniman someday. I'm sure they'd be glad to give a tour of the plant possibly, but also certainly to teach, at least to learn what they've done, because they have proactively addressed this, and hopefully some of that could be applied elsewhere. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Thank you. Representative Neuberger?
Briefly, thank you, Representative Clark Johnson. The comparison you're making here, it's a good one, but it's a little bit, and by your own admission, it's not the exact same. I think we're comparing apples to oranges. You are right. The irrigators need to be involved in their communities, but guess what? They already are. These are our family farms. These are the folks that once they get off the combine, they get in the car and they go to church and they sit in the pew and answer the people that live down the street. So there is a lot of community interaction already. Could they do a better job? Sure. I'm sure they could. And your words will be taken as well taken. But again, what we're not talking about is a major industry. We're talking about family farms. And so these are people that are in the community, and they're the ones. I mean, if there's a problem, there's going to be a phone call right away. So your analogy is a good one, but we're talking about a little bit different dynamic here. But there are parts of your argument that we'll definitely keep in mind, which are salient.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just in response to that is, yes, obviously, sand mining by a corporation is different than family farmers, and I get that real well. But what is the same here is one is an economic interest, the other is a homeowner, and that doesn't change. And as far as being members of the community, I'll tell you that people who work at Uniman live in the neighborhood. They're leaders in our community. They're the same thing. They share that as well. And so all I'm saying is that I've observed this in my district. We frequently hear in this committee that, oh, there's these challenges, et cetera. I've observed operations, whether it be Uniman. Another example I give is the Davis Dairies in Iqaluit County, which is an agricultural operation, large agricultural operation. Both of them have gone to extreme lengths to make sure that they're doing what they're doing well with respect to their neighbors. And it pays off for both of them in the long run. That the relationships are stronger in the community, but both enterprises are also stronger. And I'm hoping that rather than, I guess my goal is how do we reduce the combative atmosphere here? Mm-hmm. I'm not so sure this bill is, and I think you guys do that, to be honest with you. But how can we do that but still protect the small homeowner who doesn't have the resources, doesn't have a new well because can't afford a new well anyway, but well's still working. They're still getting water at their home. But they don't have those kinds of resources, and I don't know how we do that. I'm not convinced this is the bill. And then, of course, the issue that Representative Hoppe brought forward with the fence, I do hope you take another look at that. So thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Peterson has an answer for
Yep. Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your comments, Representative Johnson. The irrigators are not looking to get a free ride on a well interference here. What we're asking for is some fairness in this process when dealing, say, with a well interference claim. When a well interference claim is filed, the DNR is called in and they are supposed to do some investigating. And usually, if they would just come into the process and stay neutral and say, now you two need to sit down here together and talk this out to start with. That's how it's supposed to be to start. But what happens always is the person from the DNR that comes into this will walk into the room and look at the homeowner and say, don't worry, they have to give you a new well. And there's no negotiating, no process then anymore, because if we don't provide them with the drinking water, our permit is revoked and we cannot irrigate. So there's really no negotiating. And in most cases, if the irrigator, and I've known a lot of irrigators and talked with many of them, including, you know, my neighbors around the state, whatever, we have to live with our neighbors, and we will take care of the problem if we are the one at fault. And if the process would be allowed to go along to let the two sit down and talk about it, in most cases, the homeowner would realize that, you know, maybe my well is 40 years old and, you know, well, let's agree to, you know, I'll pay this much, you pay that much, and it would get taken care of. But the process doesn't get to there when the DNR personnel walk in and say, don't worry, they have to give you a new well. And so if you have a better idea to help get that process to where it's supposed to be, I'm all ears for it, because I've dealt with this too long. And it's, we're talking about water. It's a very personal thing. We all need water, and I need my neighbors to, you know, be comfortable with me farming around them, as do every irrigator and farmer in the state. So that's all we're trying to do with some of this, and that's the best I can do.
Thank you. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Neuberger, you hit a soft spot with me with your Subdivision 7 when you make it easier to convey property, within the family. You talk about your families sitting down and going to church every day, and all that is kind of a nice story. I've got a title on a family farm that's been, you know, in the family for three generations. You kind of hit a soft spot there, but I don't know when you transfer title of a property to the family, you know, I'm sure that you had good intentions there, but what happens when, let's say, you transfer title to corporate lease, agriculture company, one of the monster ag companies in the southern part of the state, and they've got control of such a large area, and then they add on another family farm, eat up another family farm, you know, all the way around their perimeter, and keep adding on to that. Does this exempt them from the from the notification of the commissioner, I guess, is what it is. I'm kind of wondering about that because, more and more we have these monster agricultural companies taking over the industry. You know, most of the people you're talking about, are the people you go to church with and that type of thing. But I'm just wondering if we can address at some time land that is leased. I don't know how those permits or well water permits transfer there, because I'm sure there's not a big danger with the smaller farms, but as ag grows and they drill deeper for water, you know, I think that's a bigger concern. I'm just wondering if you've ever seen a representative from Monsanto in church. That's just being a
rhetorical or
rhetorical.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, I sure hope I do. That would be a good place for him.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm back on the well interference, because I hear the words that you are saying. The words are, we're not asking for a free ride, we're asking for fairness. But the words of the bill are exactly the opposite. The words of the bill take away any homeowner's ability to negotiate. It's a must. There is a must in there. And so DNR must take into account a 2.5% depreciation of a well. So you've taken away from a homeowner any ability to negotiate, and you have said it's, if a well is old, even if it's working perfectly well, if it's old, then too bad, you have to pay, and the irrigator is not going to have to pay, even though, and I think the point that Representative Fisher made is that we have officers that are not recharging. And we don't want to admit that. Nobody wants to admit it. But it's happening. And we're not, we haven't had any hearings on the science or anything in this committee, and I'm disappointed in that. Because it maybe gets us into traps. And here is the trap of you're saying one thing, sounds so good, I read the bill, it's the exact opposite. So I worry about that. So we'll have to talk about what happens to the family that's been in their house for 60 years, has a 60-year-old well, and it's functioning fine. But the aquifer is not recharging, and there's a lot of irrigation well going out of it. It's reality. So that's one thing. I want to go back to the Representative Sundin brought up a good question on this successive ownership issue. DNR sometimes needs to modify those permits. And so you're saying you can't modify. And here we're back to the same thing. Aquifer is not recharging. Don't want to admit it. So still have to transfer that permit as is. A little reality would be good as we are dealing with this bill, and recharge is a huge issue in Minnesota. So I see these two places in the bill that need reworking.
Thank you.
Good time.
And I think both of the testifiers have indicated that they're willing to work with people on this. So, and Representative Neuberger has indicated that you and he are tight.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and seriously, folks, it's an issue that people are bringing forward, and I'm sure that you can get something worked out. But unless you need to respond to Representative Wagenius.
No, Mr. Chair.
Other testifiers. Representative Wagenius, excuse me, I don't hear you actually ask a question in that.
Let me ask a question. You talked of a lot of this is coming from the Little Rock watershed.
Mm-hmm.
Is that one of the watersheds?
Can you speak into the microphone, please, Representative Wagenius?
We're talking about the Little Rock watershed. Is that one of the watersheds where, excuse me, we're seeing a lot of private wells with nitrogen in their water above 10?
Representative Neuberger or Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Wagenius, there is some nitrogen concerns, but those, to my knowledge, as I've been tracking this, because I'm also working with the folks that live around the lake as well, that the problem is not so much an aquifer issue, it's a runoff issue from a few specific point sources. And right now we're working with that. So to paint the picture that all the irrigators are causing the nitrogen problems, I mean that's an argument we can have for hours, but that's not the point of this bill. What we're trying to do, again, is bring back some regulatory certainty, just some fairness to the whole equation.
Well, I didn't put on the table the issue of why the wells were. I was just asking the question of whether, and I think the answer is yes. And in that case, when we have families that are have wells that have more than 10% nitrogen, and particularly if they have children, we should be dealing with that issue too. And that's kind of a missing piece here. And Representative Hansen has a good solution. I don't know whether you've talked to Representative Hansen about his solution for the missing piece in this bill. So I don't know if you know his bill or not.
Representative Neuberger?
I'm not familiar with it, no.
I think
Mr. Peterson.
Representative Hansen can talk to that.
Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. The nitrates in water is under the jurisdiction of MDA, and they are working on that, not under the jurisdiction of the DNR.
Next on the list is Representative Hansen, and you've been summoned into this.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm glad it's a missing piece, not a missing link. I've been referred to as worse, but I think the bill that President Wagenius is talking about was a funding mechanism for replacement of wells that have high nitrate contamination, and it's, I don't remember the number right now, but it's based on not general tax dollars paying for this cost, but trying to make sure there's a connection between use and whether it's urban, suburban, or rural, all together helping pay for this cost. My question, though, Mr. Chair, and I don't know the answer to this, Representative Neuberger, kind of the discussion we've been having has been about private wells, and this came to mind when Representative Johnson brought up Uniman, because Uniman's kind of in a, there are some cities nearby. So has there been any evidence or any impact where the irrigation or the increased irrigation is impacting a public system, a small town water system, or a, because I'm just thinking there we're dealing into getting into a much larger cost, and I don't know, and maybe that's a DNR or health, but I think of as you get particularly in the sand superficial sand aquifers, that you may have some small towns that are close by that we tip into this, and maybe this is a question for the irrigators. I just don't know the answer to that.
To the testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen. Yes, there has been a few instances of some public water supplies. Litchfield is the one that comes to mind that I was familiar with a year or two ago. I don't remember the time frame. That was found during an aquifer test, and there was steps taken to make sure that that was not affected negatively so that the city could have their water.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when we get to the last section on interference, how would that apply to a public system? What would we, if we're changing the status quo, is your bill only affecting private interference, or what if we have a public system, you know, or a corporate or a business system, how does it affect those?
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair, thank you. There's no delineation here in the language, and again, the principle is the same. If you have a municipal well system that's going into the same aquifer, if that municipal well system's 100 years old, then you have to take that into account. Right? I drive a 10-year-old Chevy Impala with 200,000 miles on it, and it's got a salvage title. It's not the greatest car, but I'm not picky. If I get into an accident, and my car gets totaled, I'm not going to go to my insurance company and say, hey, buy me a brand new car. They're going to tell me that that's not rational. So the analogy here is that if you have an aging system like that, that we're just asking that we take that into consideration, that all of the factors that are involved are factored in. What we would like to make sure that we do not create in this situation when it comes to municipal water supplies is we don't want to create a trend or a negative opportunity, if there's such a thing, for a municipality to say, we can't afford a new water system, so let's go after some of our local township irrigators, some of the irrigators in the system, to try to offset the cost of replacing the system. I don't want to create that environment, Representative Hansen. And again, all we're trying to do is level the playing field here so that all the facts are taken into consideration.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But what if the science shows that that's the impact? What if the data, what if the evidence shows that that is the impact? And then, so what is the remedy? If let's say a town of 450 people has to drill a new well and they can't afford that because their property tax base is too small, or it's a town of 5,000 or 10,000 people and they have to raise their property taxes to cover a new well or a treatment system, or does it come back to us here where the general public has to bond to pay for the new well or the wastewater treatment? Then we're getting into a whole cascading effect here of your bill that I'm not sure we've really contemplated. Have you thought of that? I mean, this is a huge deal.
Well, and I'm not the chief author of the bill, and I've been listening to the discussion. I've read through it. I think that they've said several times that what they're trying to get to is a process where you can actually determine and depend upon the data, the science represented the Wagenia, so that we can come to some sort of an equitable decision. But I'll let you guys answer the question. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen. Representative Neuberger said, you know, a municipal well and a single home well, I think we're talking, they are wells. One's a well, the other's a well. But we're talking apples and oranges when you talk about construction and maintenance on that well. Most municipals are pumping 800 gallons a minute to maintain their water supply for a city, similar to, say, an irrigation or a large ag facility. They need that water. They will know quickly if their well starts to decline in production, and they need to maintain that. Different than a home well, which it might be declining in production and you wouldn't even know it, because it's just pumping that much less water.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Neuberger.
And again, what we're trying to do is look for some regulatory certainty here. If that agricultural well, if that irrigation operation is interfering with the municipality and we find that that's the case, then they pay for it. So that answers your question, Representative Hansen. If you're trying to create a scenario where we're putting small municipalities in danger, well, that's simply not the case. That's not the case. Because if the irrigator is interfering with the municipality, and that's what the facts and the science and the data shows, then they pay for it. Should they pay for a brand new system? Well, I don't know. If you hit my car in the parking lot, are you going to buy me a brand new car? No, you're not, because my car's not worth very much. So what we're trying to do is to find some parity here so that we are all on a level playing field. That's what we're looking for. And by the way, the municipality interference claims, to my knowledge, are few and far between. So what we're really dealing with here is just getting the DNR off the farmers' backs. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to levelize the playing field here. And Mr. Chair, I'd like to bring my next testifier forward, sure, if that would be possible.
I've got one more question on the list, and while your next testifier is coming forward, I'd like to recognize the FFA group that's here. I had breakfast with some of them this morning. I got to introduce myself to them and had some conversation. In the 6 years now plus that I've been in the legislature, this is one of the finest student organizations that you can come across. So congratulations and thank you for being here. And Representative Fisher, you're on the list.
Thank you. And the question I have goes right to the language on between 4.22 and 4.25 to make sure I'm understanding it correctly. It says that when an agreement is reached in terms of well interference on a well interference claim, it says the depreciation of 2.5% per year must be taken into account. So I just want to make sure I'm doing the math on that. So if it's 2.5% a year, would I be correct then saying that after 10 years, that in a well interference claim that has been proven, that the homeowner then has to pay 25% of the cost?
Excuse me, Representative Neuberger.
You're correct, Representative Fisher.
And
Representative Fisher.
Thank you. Then going on from there, that means after 20 years, the homeowner pays 50% of the cost. And after 40 years, if there's a well interference, the homeowner pays 100% of the cost. Would that be accurate then?
Representative Neuberger, when I might interject, I've been listening, and they said that they were willing to work on this section of the language already. Yeah. But Ms. Representative Neuberger?
No, you are correct, Chair Fabian, and thank you for clarifying that.
Thank you.
You're
welcome. Next, Ms. Schlichting, is it?
Yes.
Okay, would you please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony? Thank you for being here.
Thank you. My name is Marlene Schlichting. We farm just north of St. Cloud in the area known as the Little Rock Watershed, mm-hmm. Little Rock Creek Watershed. We have about 20 irrigation systems, and we have always had all the permits that we've needed with the DNR, always complied with all of the reporting, and up until around 2013, I thought we had a pretty good relationship with the DNR. In 2013, I applied to amend an existing permit. I wanted to increase the acres and the volume, which was normally a fairly straightforward process. Nothing was really happening, so after I started emailing with our local hydrologist, and after 18 months, the decision was made that they would take my existing long-term appropriation permit and turn it into a limited permit. And faced with that uncertainty, I withdrew the request. It was during that time period that I started to learn about some of the things that were happening in our area and what the DNR was concerned about. That got me to thinking about the transferring of permits, if there's a sale or a death of the current permit holder. I inquired to our local hydrologists and got a couple of different answers. Most of them were, yes, they will transfer, but there's going to be an extensive review process because of the area that we're in. Faced with that kind of uncertainty, it's very difficult to make decisions about whether or not you should buy property. I would never consider purchasing property in that area without a permit. Or without the ability to get a permit. So that's why I was looking for language that would allow for permits to be transferred without review in the event of a sale of the property or the death of the owner. And the reason I am looking for that is because without that provision, the DNR could very easily just pick us all off in 30 years. As the permit holder dies, the permit dies too. So that's my concern.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question for Representative Neuberger. On line 2.6, we've been focused on farmers, but I note that on line 2.6, you also talk about local governments. Mm-hmm. And so, if a local government is negatively impacted, you know, you talk about strategies to address the impacts must be included in the plan. What would be an example of strategies that local governments could use?
Representative Neuberger.
Representative Hornstein, thank you for your question. I want to run that by me one more time. There was a lot of verbiage in there.
Sure. Okay. I'll keep it short. Lines 2.6 and 2.7, what would be an example of a strategy that a local government could use were there economic impacts in the plan?
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, a local government would have a lot of things that would be available to them, but first thing that I would expect them to do would be to sit down with the DNR and say, look, we're going to have a significant economic impact that's going to hit us. So what can we do? Maybe they have to alter a permit, or maybe they have to change the parameters of a permit. But this is a community-based decision. If you go in and you deny a permit to a certain area, and you start to pull the economic plug on some of these farmers, some of these farmers are operating on razor-thin margins. And you're going to have to look at this. You're going to say, this is going to have an effect on our schools, on all of our local property taxes, on our public safety. It's going to have a huge effect. So if these local governments can come back, if they're involved in the equation, which they should be, they should have some say in this. So they'd be able to go back and work with the DNR to say, if we need to alter the parameters of the permit so that we don't pull the plug on our community, then they should have that available to them.
Representative Hornstein.
Let's say, you know, we have a problem with, you know, water supply, et cetera. Then what recourse would they have?
Representative Hornstein. Excuse me, Neuberger.
People confuse us a lot.
I know.
We're tight. I assume you two are tight as well.
Exactly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Yeah, we're tight. Representative Hornstein, again, what you are looking for is what all of us are looking for, and it's perfect. Perfect does not exist. I'm not going to let really good get in the way of perfect. What we have here is a workable solution that involves the community. Is it perfect? No, it's not. But is it something that gets us to a point where we would like to be instead of where we are? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Or Representative Johnson.
That chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is for Ms. Schlichting, and I just want to start by saying I'm sensitive to the challenge you have with the transfer of the permit, but I need to know a little bit more about the permits. And I hope you know the answer, but if not, maybe somebody else does. When you get a water permit, how long is that good for? Is it renewed at any given point, or?
Our permits are called long-term appropriation permits. It doesn't mean that they can't be pulled for violation or if there's an issue, but right now they just, I think they renew every year when you report your water use.
Representative Johnson, follow up.
Thank you. And then so if, as I recall, the Little Rock area has some issues with, are there issues, I should ask, are there issues with water levels in your part of the state?
That's being reviewed now, and from what I understand, there is not a problem with the aquifer in our watershed.
Representative Johnson.
Okay, thank you. So then if your point is that if you wanted to sell your land, you want to be able to pass that permit along, and likewise when you purchase land, you want to be able to purchase the permit that exists because it's central to your farming operation.
Restricting.
In our area, yes, it's absolutely essential.
And then,
if there were an issue with that permit, there's plenty of leeway for the DNR to go back, review that permit, and basically ask you to meet certain obligations due to changing conditions?
Restricting.
I think they can do that at any time. I just don't want it to be something that they can do upon the transfer of the property. And the reason for that is because it would be a way for them to just easily deny any new permits in our area, or transfer up, I should say.
Representative Johnson.
And then just the last thing. I'm just going to take that as being correct. If not, I would ask the DNR to correct that analysis. But thank you very much.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, you end up having to report your water usage data on an annual basis to the DNR, is that correct?
Restricting.
Correct.
Representative Lewick, how often do you get feedback from the DNR as to, obviously I would hope they acknowledge that so you're sure that they've got it, but too much, too little? Have you been contacted, you know, over the years? We're not sure about this, fix that, change that. What kind of relationship happens there over the life of a permit?
Restricting.
I'm in contact with our hydrologist actually quite a lot. Mm-hmm. When you report your water use, I guess I've never been reprimanded or said you're using too much or you're under-reporting. But I know that they do review it. They're very aware of how many acre inches we use on different systems. They're very aware of how many acre inches are used per crop.
When we start talking about the value of your property, is your understanding that when the assessors come out there and take a look every 3 or 4 years to see if your market value needs to be adjusted, do they look at the wells that are in place and the systems as part of that infrastructure when they do that market value assessment? Is that your perception?
Ms. Lipton?
The assessor in our area, his name is Brian Kester, and I'm not sure if they look at that or not, but I'm certain that appraisers do. If you had your land appraised, they would value it in a couple of different ways, and one of them is its best use. If it's possible that you can irrigate it, it's going to have a much, much different value than, say, dry land that is too small to put an irrigation system on.
I understand, and I probably didn't phrase that the way it should have, but my understanding is that typically when you make a significant investment that's part of the property, utilities, that includes a well, quite often the assessor is going to immediately add that to your, I mean, it's just literally an automatic, and it won't be 3 years later if there was some type of a mechanism, a new permit, for example, at least the local level, that goes right to the assessor's office and says, whoops, you built a new garage, you put a new well in, you put in a new... So the point I'm trying to make here, and this goes back to Representative Johnson's comments, the certainty, and I know people here goes on fire sometimes when we start using the word certainty around here, there's really something said about some certainty that when there's an opportunity to pass that property, and it may be the death in the family, it may be simply folks looking to retire, that permit really should be considered to be truly a long-term permit. In other words, if the new person, the new property owner comes in, doesn't change anything, and continues to follow the permit, that is a huge long-term capital investment that's with that property, and we should be encouraging that type of thing to continue, both from a property tax standpoint for the rest of the taxpayers in the area, and I see this at a different level when I was on a local planning commission, and our conditional use permits went with the property, basically. In almost all cases, we did a few special ones, but in general, if you had a convenience store there, provided the new owner didn't want to make any radical changes, there was no question that that conditional use permit was going to continue. All we wanted to know was who the new owner was and who the new phone numbers were. So I think you're really onto something there that we need to make sure that there's some, again, I know people get really nervous when you use the word certainty here. That's a huge capital investment for the whole community because there's that tax revenue that comes to benefit everybody when you make an improvement like that. So we really need to work on that to make sure there's no even a perception of a threat that it's all going up in the air and now my property's devalued. Sometimes we have to sell property, get out of the business through conditions completely we have no control over. Particularly if you have a small operation and you have a death in the family or an injury or an illness that just takes them out of the picture, they've got to quit farming. And then to be faced with the uncertainty of the value of the property is just something we got to fix. Thank you.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier and the community, I guess. We've been over this many, many times, and it's not a secret. The testifier is correct that there's monitoring all the time. We know where the water is all the time. We test it for chemicals. And if there is a problem, the agencies can pull your permit. Mm-hmm. And so it's not like now that you have the permit, you can say, I have this, get off my property. That's not the way it works. I think they do a good job, and thank you for coming today.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Schlichting, and my question following up on Representative Lewick on taxes. So with the, and I don't know the answer to this, can you take an accelerated depreciation on a new well, or is there a difference with the actual well and the appurtenances, the connections? Let's say you have a circular system that's attached to it. How is that taxed? Can you take that, write that off right away, or is it some other way of dealing with that on your schedule?
Restricting.
So you're asking if the well itself can be depreciated differently from the irrigation system?
Yes.
It's been a while since we put in a well, but...
Mr. Chair, I think correct me if I'm wrong, Representative Hansen, but I see this in the energy industry as well. So are you talking about the actual value of the machinery, or are you talking about the production value of the water coming out?
Representative Hansen.
We need to delineate that, because if you're talking about the nuts and bolts, that's one thing. If you're talking about production value, that's a whole other thing.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm talking about construction and the development of the well. So you put in a new well, mm-hmm. you have the labor and the installation and the materials. And I fill out a farm schedule, so there's things that I can write off, and there's things that I can't. There's things that are different costs. So you have the well. And then you have things that are connected to the well, potentially, depending on your system. So, and my purpose for this is because property taxes were brought up, and I'm trying to see if on your income taxes, and the contrast comes in, I don't believe a rural resident who's not farming can write off the cost of a new well, because it's not part of their business, it's part of their residence. And I'm trying to see here if, as a business, and you put in a new well, you put in a chemigation system, you put in you replace the wheel, you replace the piping, or you go to a different, you modernize and get a more of a drip system rather than a spray system. Are those things eligible for capital or accelerated deductions?
Mr. Schlichting, do the
and maybe the association, but I was just thinking from your business.
I would say that they probably are deductible. Because if you, let's say I wanted to put in an irrigation system and it was going to cost $100,000 and that's with the machinery and the well driller, that I would report to my tax accountant as equipment, all of it together. Yeah.
And
Representative Hansen.
And Mr. Chair, and so a rural resident, I'm just thinking if I have to replace my well on my farm, that would, depending on the depth, just like on the depth of an irrigation system, it's going to drive cost. You could be $10,000, $20,000 potentially on a private residence well. Your costs are going to be much different, much higher.
Mm-hmm.
But they would be able to be, they're taxed differently than a rural resident having to replace a well. I think.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. I think this is a rabbit that we're chasing that we really don't need to. I mean, you're talking about tax equity. I mean, if we want to have that discussion with Chair Davids, I'd be more than happy to. But I think I know where you're going with this and the direction that you're heading. You can also, there's the other side of the argument, you could always ask the testifier, did you pay sales tax on that equipment, and what did that cost you? So if you're trying to build a premise for an argument that because you're a farmer and you irrigate and you get a tax break on your equipment and you're a residential owner and you don't get a tax break on your residential well, you know, that I think what you were doing here is apples and oranges.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to bring up just a little bit here. The author of the bill continues to project as to what people are thinking or their rationale for their questions, and trying to answer questions that aren't asked. I'm trying to ask this question because I don't know the answer. And I think it's relevant when we're talking about cost. So, Representative Neuberger, you can think of what I'm thinking any time, but that's not what I'm thinking. And don't answer the questions that I'm not asking. I'm asking this question because I want to know the answer. And I'm trying to find out because I think it's relevant.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier and the author, we heard that occasionally permits are canceled or withdrawn or eliminated, whatever you want to call it. I'm just wondering if there's anybody here that can answer how often that happens and why. Representative Green, I think, mentioned something about chemicals and wells. And I'm worried about the quality of the water under that land. We talked about the value of the land and transferring it, you know, to the next generation of farmers or whatever. That land, if the water underneath it is not usable and accessible, and, you know, I'm sorry that we have to even regulate this at the state level, you know, because most farmers are responsible. They want to preserve that, but some are not. And, you know, we can transfer land for the next generation of farmers, but we're also transferring those aquifers. So we need to maintain them and make certain there's an abundance. But I would like to know how many of those permits are canceled.
I think that'd be a question for DNR, but maybe you have an answer, Ms. Schlichting.
I've always been compliant, so.
Yeah, thank you.
I don't know.
I'd like to bring up our next testifier. We do want to get through these, Mr. Perkins and Mr. Gerber, if he's around.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Perkins is not testifying today.
Okay, very good.
Yeah, he got smart and went to Arizona.
Perkins, I'm sorry. Okay. While he's coming down, Representative Johnson, you had a quick question.
Mr. Chair, a little bit on what Representative Hansen was alluding to, but there's a difference to what he was alluding to. In the irrigation, that is a business expense. It should be in the business with the, just like any other equipment. The drinking well in the neighbor's home is just like the drinking well at the farmer's home. Is not tax deductible. They both have the same issues. And a lot of time, if that irrigation system is by the owner's home, he's probably going to want to feel the effect of it first, and he's going to be watching that. If there's an issue with his own well, he's going to be one of the first ones to be taking care of it. Just like if there's an issue at his neighbor's home, he wants to know about it so he can deal with it.
Thank you. Mr. Gerber, would you please identify yourself for the record and who you represent? Proceed with your testimony.
Right. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Daryl Gerber, and I am the Natural Resources Associate at Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. And thank you for the opportunity this morning to express some of our concerns about House File 1387. I'll just want to make a few points about some parts of the bill. First, the first section concerning the calcareous bends. I want to point out that really, as has been brought up, they are one of the rarest and most sensitive ecosystems that you'll find in Minnesota, and that the groundwater is really the lifeblood to these bends. And if you cut those off, then you are cutting off what sustains them and makes them viable. So we see the provision of the bill that requires DNR to allow the lifeblood to be cut as a sure path to the irreparable loss of these bends across the state. Second, the two sections requiring a study of the economic impacts of changes to plans is really a costly and unnecessary step that doesn't really do much more than slow down the planning process. And then the last section on the provision of the bill that requires the use of the depreciation schedule in well interference settlements. I think it's been brought up a number of times. I appreciate the questions that have really hit on some of our concerns of really as being an unnecessary piece that is I appreciate Representative Hansen's terminology, is a one-size-fits-all approach to something that really doesn't actually address many of the concerns that were brought up, which are actually very specific to each of the cases. And we feel that it's a lot better to actually deal with these situations on a case-by-case situation. Wells depreciate on different schedules depending on where they're drilled. And that this approach actually is a detriment to those small families, rural families that are depending on the drinking water. The value of that water to these families does not depreciate over time. It is just as valuable today as it will be 40 years from now. And we don't see this as really needing to be changed at this time. So thank you for the opportunity to speak today, and I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gerber. I appreciate you being here. Got one other testifier on the list. Before I do that, this is an open public meeting. If there's anybody here wishing to testify for or against the bill. Mr. Meyer, Mr. Representative Cornish.
Before we close, there's a member possibly from Monsanto in the crowd here, and I just wondered if Representative Sundin would like to apologize or at least admit that was a very bad joke, asking if anybody from Monsanto was ever on church. I don't think I should question companies or people if they go to church.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll personally apologize to anyone for that, but not to Monsanto.
Okay, Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, take up for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources, and thank you for allowing us to testify on this bill. I think the discussion has been great and very important. I'm just going to run through section by section some of our concerns. The discussion on the calcareous fens was excellent. These are the unique resources. We have about 200 officially identified calcareous fens in the state. Most of these are small. Mr. Gerber was absolutely right. The groundwater is the life essence of these facilities or these natural resources. 2,400 acres comprises less than 0.2% of the state's total wetland acreage. We need to preserve these as much as possible. Representative Johnson, your discussion about Uniman. We did work with Uniman on their appropriations permit, but they were required to install and operate a groundwater infiltration system to sustain the fen for the life of the project at a cost of a lot of money. And they're very willing to do that. So I think most of the permittees we work with, they do develop fen management plans, but we need to make sure that they aren't dried up and impacted. As far as the section of the bill requiring transfer of a permit, we do that right now. I mean, that's a common practice. We transfer permits to owners all the time. The economic impact pieces, I think what wasn't discussed is what's the economic impact to a local unit of government such as the city of Park Rapids for their water treatment system for the nitrate contamination that's there. So we're not economic experts. We probably have to work with the Department of Economic Development or some other experts on that. But the impacts that are there are both on the producer and on the local communities and on the citizens who have to pay increased property taxes for that water treatment or the lack thereof. We aren't a last-in, first-out state. I mean, there's a lot of talk about consistency. Our groundwater resources are not consistent throughout the state. Where we're seeing problems are on these very loose soil areas where there's rapid infiltration of groundwater, of surface water into the groundwater, perhaps, and our groundwater management areas deal with the unique characteristics, hydrogeological instances in certain parts of the state. For the thousands and thousands of permits we issue, we hear about a handful, basically. And I can give the committee the numbers of the permits that we've denied, and that when we're denying or putting conditions on these permits, it's for the long-term sustainability of the water resource. It's not to penalize anyone. So the economic impact goes both ways. We need to talk about that. I don't know who we can work with to do that piece. I think, it's, as the author talked about consistency, the only thing that is consistent about this bill is the mandated reduction in the value of somebody's well. I mean, the last section, and I hope this gets worked on, because after 40 years, Representative Fisher, you're absolutely right. Now we have to go back and say, sorry, there is no value to your well. And when we do that, we will say the legislature passed this law against the DNR's wishes because we feel that it's not right to mandate the depreciation. Maybe this should be discussed in the Commerce Committee where you're mandating depreciation of people's values. So those are just some of our major concerns with this bill, and we look forward to working with the author.
Thank you. Just one thing to your testimony. You said you're not economic experts. Mr. Julek may disagree with that. But. Representative Wagenius. Okay. Representative Clark Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm curious about, you bring up the situation in Park Rapids, and you talk about the economic impact on the city of Park Rapids. I've been curious about the economic impact on the region of Park Rapids, which is a major tourism area. That's their number one industry. And have you been able to at all look at, or have you tried to look at, the economic impact of nitrates in the water in that region and its impact on the tourism industry?
Mr. Chairman,
Commissioner Meyer, remember you have not economic experts too, so go ahead.
I don't have any information on that. I can see what we have, but I can get back to the committee if we do have some information on that.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the Commissioner, as we were talking about the changes that were in there, I know that you're referring the economic impacts, that you want to take a look at the whole thing. I was wondering, as I noticed that the groundwater management plan area was also calling out for economic impacts and there are new restrictions or policies. How would that impact your ability to work in areas where we already know we have issues with water? Is that going to potentially change how we approach that? Is it going to try to impact what priorities might be happening in the area? Because I do know when you've got, in some areas where it's limited water, you have to start thinking of reallocating. How is this all going to impact and have an impact on these areas?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fisher, that's an excellent question. Specifically, as we look at the North and East Metro groundwater management area, what is the economic impact of of not allowing the city of Hugo to grow anymore because there's no groundwater available? What's the economic impact of requiring cities to switch from groundwater to surface water? Those are things that we'd have to try to figure out with other partners. Strategies to address economic impacts could be included in any plan. I would assume the major strategy would be water conservation. As we try to preserve our water and save what we have, I mean, watering lawns, washing cars, doing all those things with water are things that need to be discussed, as well as water conservation at the municipal and the business level.
President Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to our testifier here again. So as we talk about where we have limited water and a community's availability to grow, that's would be actually growth of the domestic water supply in that case, correct?
Commissioner.
Chair, Representative Fisher, yes.
Okay, and so that is... Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, to our testifier again, so that is the number one use of water in the priority system that the DNR has, correct?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, depending how some of this is allocated out, we could find that we may have some lower uses, ag, or some of those other areas that are much lower in the priority list, trying to limit the growth and use of the number one use of the domestic water supply then, correct?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, yes, there is a water hierarchy established in statute that does outline how that would work.
Okay.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In a groundwater management area, we've got these restrictions out there. There may have to be, if we don't find new uses of water and if the conservation is enough, some of the lower uses may have to be given, have to lose some of their permits to make sure that the domestic water supply is kept in the future then. Is that a possibility?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fisher, we would examine all permits in those areas based upon the hierarchy and act accordingly.
Okay.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the reason I hit on this is this groundwater management system is new, and we've got not just a couple of areas of the state that we have issues on. We've got a number of other areas where we have issues. Some of it may be groundwater quality, and some of it is that there's a shortage in the area. And I think what this bill does is it complicates the efforts trying to address in a long-term sustainable way of how we address our water uses in the future. And I think some of this is what complicates it is we've not really had the chance to hear some of the science that's involved around it. And I think also some of these get to more of long-term decisions that are much more complicated, where we need the Legislative Water Commission spending more time. An example that I've used before is in areas when we have our next drought. Back in 87, we had severe droughts in the area, and there was a lot of controversy as water allocations were made or requests from water to be released from reservoirs in northern Minnesota. And I think that some of these are complicated and new enough that we need to be having bigger broad-based bipartisan discussions that we can't accomplish in a smaller committee like this on our limited time schedule. And so I just kind of want to put that out there, is that we need to be taking advantage of using these other tools that are available to us out there.
Thank you. Members, we have about 2 minutes left.
Mr. Chairman, just
yep, Commissioner.
Really quickly, I didn't comment on Section 4 of the bill that talks about data that the denied applicant would be required to have. This is currently public data. If the permittee requests this information, we provide it to them. The author spoke that some people get some information, some people get deluge of information. We give people what they want. If they ask for their entire file, we'll give them a copy of it. It just depends on what people want. Some people don't want to have all that information, but it is public information available at any time upon request.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question was if maybe Ms. Taylor could provide to the committee if we have a summary of the difference between Western Water Law and the Fair Use or Fair Share Doctrine, because I think a lot of what we're running into is confusion about that particular issue. First is gets it or fair share. So I don't know if you have that, Ms. Taylor, or if you can get something from Nonpartisan House Research. Just
Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members, I do not have that prepared personally, but I believe there's a lot of resources out there that I could probably pull together.
Thank you. Representative Morghini, you're on the list. Can we,
real quick.
I want to get going here, please. I've got another meeting.
Okay. One of the things that is missing in this bill is the discussion and the resolution for the folks in Little Rock who have polluted wells where the nitrogen is over 10. And I know one of the testifiers said that, well, this is a DNR bill, it's not a Department of Health bill. But there is no no limitation on putting two departments in one bill. So it does seem that when we see this again, we should see this other, the solution for the folks who have polluted wells.
Thank you. Everyone, you have 20 seconds.
20 seconds. It's a good bill. I appreciate your support. It's been a good, robust debate here. I'm willing to work on this final section about the depreciation. We can have offline discussions with that. And with that, Mr. Chair, I renew my motion to have this laid over for possible inclusion in the later omnibus bill.
Thank you. With that, the bill is laid over and we are adjourned.